True Crime Historian has been made possible in part by scoundrels like Marley Walker, whose work keeping the Safe House kennels clean has proven to be invaluable. You too can lay low and join the party at www.patreon.com/truecrimehistorian to enjoy ad-free editions of all new episodes, treasures from the True Crime Historian vault not available anywhere else, exclusive content, and whatever personal services you require. Also, a shout of thanks to Mish, Nessa, and Intergarlictic, who recently threw a couple of chits on the bar at www.buymeacoffee.com/crimehistorian. We appreciate the generosity.
PaulBueller.com.
Kokomo, Indiana, August 23rd, 1877. There occurred at the junction, a few minutes before 7 o'clock last evening, one of the most cold-blooded, most heartless murders it has ever been our lot to know. While policeman Thomas W. Lannon was sitting on the depot platform at the crossing talking to a party of friends, he was approached by Michael Galluli, who, without uttering a word of warning, leveled a revolver at him and mercilessly shot him down. At the first shot, which entered the ill-fated man's mouth, poor Lannon attempted to run into the sitting room of the depot. As he entered the door, Galluli fired another, and the fatal shot, which entered poor Lannon's back a little to the right and in the region of the heart. He staggered to the lunch counter and said to Mr. Weichel, who was in attendance there, "Run for the priest," and from thence out the east door and into the telegraph office, where he fell on the floor with his life's blood gushing in torrents from his eyes, mouth, and nostrils. In a few moments, the good Father Lorderman was by the side of the dying man, pointing him to Jesus. Immediately after committing this diabolical crime, Galluli walked leisurely over to his boarding house, but a few squares away, brandishing his revolver and threatening to shoot the first man that laid hands on him. On his arrival at the house, he told his landlord what he had done and said he was going downtown to give himself up to the officers. He immediately came downtown and was arrested at Walnut Street, opposite Irvin's drugstore, by policeman Freeland and Constable Burke, who lodged him in jail, where he now is. He had no revolver on his person when arrested, nor did he resist the officers.
True Crime Historian presents Yesterday's News, tales of classic scandals, scoundrels, and scourges told through vintage newspaper accounts from the golden age of yellow journalism. Episode 443 tells the story of the first officer to be killed in the line of duty in Kokomo, Indiana. But was the violent action against him provoked or spurred on by a notorious local gang? The question divided the growing Indiana town. I'm true crime historian Richard O. Jones, and for your horror and indignation, I give you Assassination at Kokomo Junction, the Galluli Lannon Affray.
Thomas Lannon, the murdered policeman, was an Irishman by birth, a Catholic, and one of the most ardent working members of the Father Matthew Temperance Society of this city. His age was 28, and he was unmarried. We understand, however, that he was soon to have been married to a most estimable Irish young lady. During last May, he was put on the police force and has served efficiently ever since. He had no fear, never shirked duty, and performed his work well. Mr. Lannon was beloved by all who knew him well. He has always borne a good character, was a good officer, and was held in high esteem by the Catholics. He has no near relatives living here. Michael McGlynn of this city was a brother-in-law to Lannan. The remains were taken to Richmond for burial on Thursday afternoon. Two sisters of the deceased reside there. He had no other relatives, his parents being both dead. Services were held at the Catholic Church, Father Lordeman pronouncing a fitting eulogy over the remains and reciting the sad manner of his death. The Father Matthew Society, the City Council, and many citizens accompanied the body to the depot. Michael Galluli, on whose soul rests the blood of his murdered victim, is an Irishman of about 25 years of age. He is unmarried and claims to be a Catholic, but the church does not own him. He is closely knit, of average size, with deep red hair. He is a hard-working man, but slightly given to drink. At present, he is a section hand under John Grady on the north section of the IP&C Railroad. He had been drinking yesterday, but was not drunk when he fired the fatal shot. The cause of the murder is said to lie in the fact that some 4 weeks ago, Lannan had arrested Galluli at a house of ill fame. Galluli had said it was a setup job and seemed to hold malice against the officer. Coroner Ross held an inquest over the body last night. Galluli was found guilty in the mayor's court and fined. At the time, he threatened Lannan's life, and it is said that several times since, he has said that he would kill Lannan before he left the city. It seems that the opportunity to gratify his murderous nature did not come until last Wednesday evening at 6:30. Policeman Lannan was sitting on the depot platform, conversing with some friends, with no thought of his speedy death that was soon to follow. Michael Galluli approached Lannan from the left side and a little to the rear of him, deliberately drew a revolver, and shot him in the left ear, remarking as he did so, "There, you b**k of a b**k, take that." Lannan started running into the depot, but was closely pursued by his murderer, who again fired at him, the last shot passing into the back, its range being directly below the heart. Lannan found his way first into Weichel's restaurant and asked him to send for the priest. Then he ran into the telegraph office, where he fell on the floor, expiring instantly with the words, "The priest," issuing from his lips. Soon the junction was wild with excitement. The depot was thronged with people, and the question on everybody's lips was, "What has become of Galluli?" He had walked across the railroad to his boarding house when he concluded that he might as well not try to get away and started downtown, intending, no doubt, to give himself up to the authorities. At Irvin's drugstore, he was met by Policeman Freeland and Constable Burke, who had once arrested him and lodged him in jail. Coroner Ross proceeded promptly to the scene of the murder and impaneled a jury. Not much evidence was taken, it being deemed unnecessary. Only 5 witnesses were examined. The first was John McGuire. Quote, "I saw the shooting. Michael Galluli did it. I think there were 3 shots fired. I was not more than 2 steps from Galluli when he shot. The shooting was done between 6 and 7 o'clock. It took place under the shed under the north side of the express office. Lannan was standing up. Galluli said after the shooting that if anybody laid hands on him, he would serve them the same. I was only slightly acquainted with Galluli. I never heard him make any threats as to whether he was going to shoot Lannan. I did not see Lannan fall. Lannan was about 6 to 9 feet from Galluli." Unquote. Michael Sullivan was the next witness called. Quote, "Galluli shot twice at Lannan that I know of. He was not more than 10 feet from him. I was about 3 feet from Galluli when he fired. Lannan was standing up. When I came from supper to the junction, I saw Galluli have a revolver in his hand, and he was shooting at a boxcar across the Panhandle Railroad. I am not very well acquainted with Galluli. I think that there was something wrong with him. He was walking up and down the railroad. Lannan was in the habit of coming up to the junction every evening just about train time, unquote. Thomas Sullivan testified, quote, I was at the junction when the shooting was done. I saw Glooley pull the revolver out of his right-hand pocket and cock it and walked right over to Lannan and shot. He shot him twice that I know of. I do not think he lived many minutes after he was shot. I did not hear any conversation between them. They were not over 10 feet apart. Lannan was standing up. I was about 3 feet from Glooley when he shot. Unquote. William Flannery was the next witness. Quote, I was standing about 3 feet from Lannan when he was shot. Glooley was standing on the platform and was about 10 feet from Lannan, who was standing with his side toward Glooley. When Glooley came up, Lannan turned around and looked toward him. I was not at the junction more than 5 minutes before the shooting was done. I saw the revolver in Glooley's hand and I saw him shoot Lannan. I don't think Lannan lived over 3 minutes after he was shot. Unquote. Dr. W. K. Mavity was the last witness examined. Quote, I have examined the body of Thomas Lannan. One ball entered his left ear and ranged inward and a little upward. I introduced a probe about 4 1/4 inches without meeting any resistance. The ball taking that direction entered and wounded the base of the brain. The second ball entered the body on the back between the 4th and 5th ribs, immediately below the left scapula. This ball entered the cavity of the chest and wounded the lungs. The wound in the ear was sufficient to produce almost instant death and was the cause of his death. Unquote. The jury, having heard the evidence and completed its labor, brought in a verdict in accordance with the above facts, quote, that the deceased came to his death at the hands of Michael Glooley, unquote, as set forth in the evidence. In order to be satisfied that all the evidence had been obtained that was possible, and at the request of the prosecuting attorney, Coroner Ross and Drs. Mavity and Scott made a post-mortem examination of the body of Lannan on Thursday morning. The facts elicited conform precisely with the verdict rendered by the jury. On Thursday morning, a Tribune reporter visited the jail and sought an interview with the murderer, but was told that, quote, he didn't care to say anything, unquote. When he was informed that public opinion was very much prejudiced against him and it was for his own interest to make a defense if he had any, he only answered, I don't care to talk about the matter. On Thursday afternoon, our reporter again visited him with a better result, although only meager answers could be obtained to the few questions asked. The prisoner was very reticent about saying anything relative to the shooting, and although our reporter introduced this subject several times, Glooley would always evade the questions. In stature, the murderer is of medium height, rather heavy set and smooth face except mustache, which is like his hair, very straight and red in color. Glooley's not a bad-looking man. It is common for people to say of a criminal, well, he has the bad eye, he looks like a murderer. Such an expression would hardly be made of Glooley. When the writer applied at the prison grate for him, he was accompanying a rear cell and at first refused to come out. When we assured him that no questions would be asked about the murder, he appeared and with hanging head gave up the following information. I was born in Sandusky, Ohio, where I lived until I was 6 years of age. I am now 23 years old. I went from there to Dayton, Ohio, then to Lima. I came to this state 4 years ago, stopped first at Noblesville, have been here since January 15th, and have been at work as a section hand on the IP&C Railroad. I was arrested by Lannan 4 weeks ago in a house of ill fame, and was taken before the mayor and fined. My mother lives at Sandusky, Ohio. I am in the habit of drinking some, was pretty drunk last night. I never had any trouble before. After the shooting, we went over to Welsh's, where I bored, and then came down intending to give myself up to the police. I didn't try to run away. I don't care to talk much about the affair now. Unquote. From George Craycraft of Doxy's Stave Factory, we learn that when Galluli first came to town, he applied there for work, stating that he had walked from Logansport and had nothing to eat for 3 days. Mr. C. gave him 50 cents and told him to look about during the day, and if he could not find work, to return in the evening. Galluli returned at dusk, stating that he had tried in vain to procure work. Mr. C. employed him in the factory for 3 weeks. During that time, he was diligent at work, showed no laziness, and was strictly sober. When he left the factory, he commenced to work on the railroad. Yesterday afternoon, Galluli sent for a Tribune reporter to visit him, and when the writer called at the jail, the prisoner made the following statement. Quote, "I am sorry I shot Tom Lannan. I am confident I would not have done it if I had not been under the influence of liquor. A report came to me that he had made threats against my life, and of course I was on my guard. I believed that he would shoot me, and under the influence of liquor this belief aggravated me to do the deed. I am confident I would never have killed him if I had been in my sober senses. I never had it in my heart before to kill any man, and was never engaged in fights or fracases. If I was shooting at a boxcar, as one of the witnesses said, I do not know of it. I don't remember anything about that. I was never confined in jail for any misbehavior before Lannan arrested me. I can only say I am sorry, very sorry, that I killed Tom Lannan. I am not in the habit of visiting houses of ill fame. The night Lannan arrested me was the first time I had gone to such a place in town. There were 8 or 9 visited the house that night, and no other arrest was made. I wasn't in the house more than 2 minutes before I was arrested. I never threatened Tom Lannan's life. I said I would thrash him someday, but I never said to anyone that I would kill him." October 20th, 1877. The jury in this case was impaneled last Saturday, and the trial was fairly begun on Monday morning. Mr. Fred Vail, the prosecutor, acquitted himself grandly. He occupied 4 hours in his address to the jury, and all agreed that his effort was a masterly one. Messrs. O'Brien and Garrigus for the defense also did their entire duty and made as strong a defense as could be made in such a case. They also occupied the 4 hours to which they were limited. The facts in the case are known to all, as they are of such recent occurrence. Galluli was at hand on one of the railroad sections. Lannan was a policeman. The latter arrested the former in a house of ill fame and placed him in jail. Galluli planned revenge, and no effort to compromise had any influence upon him. Father Lordeman, the Catholic priest, also testified that he had tried to heal the breach between Galluli and Lannan at several times, but while the latter seemed willing, Galluli would always say, "No, one of us has got to die one of these days." He prepared himself, practiced shooting, and then did shoot and kill. If it were not murder, there can be no murder. It was the habit of many, as is always the case in the courthouse, to say, "Galluli looks like a murderer. This is all bosh. We tried the old catch." On being asked, "Where is the prisoner?" we pointed out one of the best and most inoffensive men in town, whereupon the usual remark was made, "There is murder in his eye." Galluli has not a bad face. He is a small man of neat form, light red hair which is thin even to baldness, wears a mustache only. His face is one of the shiny sort. His eye is full and expressive. He is really beyond the average of his class in good looks. The argument closed just after 12 o'clock noon on Wednesday, when Judge Pollard delivered his charge to the jury. After Judge Pollard had instructed the jury as to the manner of returning a verdict, that body retired. Here's a helpful hint. You can easily avoid the advertising by listening to True Crime Historian at the Safe House. Register at www.patreon.com/truecrimehistorian. Only one execution ever took place in Kokomo, and that was managed by a crowd of excited citizens on the night of May 28, 1863, and took place in the courthouse square on the north side of the yard. Some of our older citizens remember well the circumstances that brought about the hanging. On the morning of Wednesday, May 27, 1863, two desperados rode into town on stolen horses and attempted to sell them to Nelson Cooper, who then kept a livery stable on the north side of the square. As they came into town, they stopped on the Union Street Bridge across Wildcat, and after carefully examining their pistols to see if they were well loaded, they shook hands and took an oath that they would never be captured, not while they had a ball in their pistols. The deputy sheriff, Harry Stewart, had received warning the day previous that the two thieves were moving this way and would probably reach Kokomo during the week, and was warned to capture them when they made their appearance. So Stewart remained about the livery stable and was present when the men offered the horses for sale. He at once identified the stolen property and made inquiries as to where the men got them. One replied, "I raised them," but suspecting that he was suspicioned, he said to Mr. Cooper, "If you want them for $100 apiece, you can have them. If not, we will go," and immediately turned his horse's head to ride away. Deputy Sheriff Stewart at once made an effort to grab the bridle of one end and told Mr. Cooper to seize the other, which he proceeded to do. Immediately, the thief that Stewart seized drew his pistol and shot Cooper dead on the spot. He then fired again at Stewart, who dropped under the horse's feet, and the shot missed him, but hit Mr. John Lowe, who expired in a half an hour afterwards. The thief then fired a third shot at the deputy, which grazed his hand, at the same time starting a gallop down the street. In crossing the railroad, his saddle turned and threw him when he started to run. Tommy Otter, now deceased, caused the saddle to turn by throwing rocks. The murderer tried to shoot Outer, but his pistol would not revolve. It was dodging the rocks that turned the saddle. By this time, numerous citizens had started in pursuit, and the murderer had only ran a few yards when Henry B. Seward fired at him, the ball taking effect in the hip and bringing him down. John Stewart, the father of Henry, at once disarmed the fellow. He was taken into Howard House, his wounds were dressed, and he was removed to jail. His accomplice drew a revolver but did not fire it, starting to ride away. A posse of citizens soon mounted horses and followed in pursuit. After riding about a mile or two, he abandoned his horse and took to the woods. He was not captured, if we remember correctly, until a year or two subsequently, when he was arrested near Fort Wayne for some criminal offense and then sent to the state prison for 7 years. The murderer gave his name as Jones and said his home was in West Virginia, where his wife, two children, and mother then resided. A strong guard, under the command of Lieutenant Black of the 20th Indiana Volunteers, was placed at the jail during Wednesday night, and the prisoner was not disturbed. But on the night following, about 9 o'clock, a strong body of citizens marched to the jail, took the prisoner and conducted him to the public square where a flimsy gallows had been erected. Here, the mob faltered in its purpose, and it is quite likely the fellow would not have been hung if he had not adjusted the noose to his own neck, fixed the knot at the proper place, and then the box was kicked out from under him by a man who has since moved away from here. The man was, perhaps, as cool as any criminal who stood on the brink of damnation. While adjusting the rope to his own neck, he encouraged the boys not to falter, said it would make no difference to him, for he would have to hang soon anyhow. He expressed regret at having killed Mr. Cooper, saying he was a young man with good prospects. But in regard to killing Mr. Lowe, he said, "I don't regret it. He was an old man, a good Christian, prepared for heaven, and shooting him was only to send him to glory a little before his time." Thus he kept on talking while he adjusted the rope, and he stood with it about his neck some time, when Mr. D, himself worse scared than the murderer, kicked the box from under the desperado, leaving him dangling in midair. The body was left hanging all night, and a drenching rain set in, which made a hideous sight next morning when the remains were taken down by John Stewart and interred on the hillside just east of the old cemetery. The noose that was put around the murderer's neck is now in the possession of John Stewart and can be seen at his store on the east side of the square. The clouded sky and steady rain of Wednesday afternoon did not greatly exhilarate the gloomy spirits of Michael Galluli as he lay in his cell at the county jail, waiting for the jury's verdict. Reader, did you ever think what a prisoner's feelings must be when awaiting a verdict that may end his life and send him into eternity, with a conscience stained with the blood of a neighbor? Galluli maintained that stolid indifference which he has manifested all along through the afternoon and night of Wednesday. His only hope was a verdict of imprisonment for life, his only fear that the death penalty would be inflicted. When it was announced Wednesday morning that the jury had agreed upon a verdict, it was not long until the courtroom was filled with curious listeners, who seemingly manifested much more interest in the sealed verdict than did the prisoner who was brought into court at 9 o'clock. Under circumstances like these, a fearful silence pervades the courtroom that is not unlike the scenes surrounding a deathbed. Every second seems an hour. Curious people, eager to hear the verdict, look into the faces of the jurors and try to find an expression. In this case, no clue was given. The face of every juror was stolid. In sepulchral voice, the judge called out, "Gentlemen, have you agreed upon a verdict?" The foreman, J.S. Allison, responded, "We have." "What is your verdict, gentlemen of the jury?" There was only a vague look of interest by the prisoner as a little slip of white paper was handed to the judge. Then there was painful anxiety visible upon Galluli's face. He only waited a moment to hear the death sentence. Quote, "We, the jury, find the defendant guilty as charged in the first count of the indictment of murder in the first degree and make his penalty death." Unquote. The jurors all bowed assent to the judge's question, "Is this your verdict, gentlemen?" When a poll of the jury was taken, each responded yes in a clear but solemn voice. A deathly paleness crept over Galluli's face, but passed off quickly. Then there was a flush and some nervousness as he was taken from the room. The jury is to be congratulated upon the fact that a great duty has been done. Many persons are opposed to capital punishment, but if it is ever right, it is right in this case. This man resisted the kind offices of friends, declined every compromise, and declared that blood must be shed. Who sheddeth man's blood by man, shall his blood be shed. The verdict was in exact accordance with the law and with the evidence.
October 27th, 1877.
Before our last paper was issued, several ladies called to ask us to take a strong stand against the execution of the murderer Galluli. Our opinion in regard to hanging has been so frequently expressed that it is well known to the reader, but we had come to the conclusion that since shooting is so common here, since crime so often goes unpunished, that somebody ought to be hung just for the lesson. We believe that the jury, under the law and evidence, did its duty. All our private feelings are against hanging, but this case was so outrageous, so uncalled for, and criminals are growing so brazen that we could not, in our conscience, oppose the full execution of the verdict in this case. Since our last paper was issued, we have received a dozen letters, all on one side and all from females. Below, we print most of the contents of one of these letters. It was not written for publication, but we suppress the name so she cannot feel aggrieved. We may say, however, that she is a lady of education. We select this one because it was written with more care than any of the others received. Under the date of last Saturday and at this city, she writes, "Mr. Phillips, you will pardon me, after having read this, for intruding upon your time and patience. I cannot rest without making an effort, feeble though it may be, to have the sentence passed upon Mr. Galluli changed. I lay thinking nearly all last night about him and wondering who there was that would do anything for the poor, heartbroken creature. At last, something seemed to whisper to me, 'Write to Mr. Phillips. He has a kind heart, influential friends, and will do all he can for him.' Mr. Galluli is an entire stranger to me. I have never spoken a word to him, nor had I ever seen him but once before his trial. Yet the sentence is so terrible and unjust, I hope God, who alone is perfect, will send him friends and help. It seems to me there was never a more unjust verdict rendered to any human being. If they did not hang others in town and county who have committed just the same crime, and I do not know but still worse, why hang this man? If a jury lets some guilty persons go free or inflicts a slight punishment upon them simply because they are protected by money, friends, and secret societies, I think it is but right that the citizens of this city take this and all other criminal cases in their hands and have some justice meted accordingly. Some persons delight to see others in trouble, and if they have it in their power, will give them a downward push. They never seem to think that perhaps the same trouble at some distant hour, day, month, or year may visit their own hearthstones. The old adage, though not very elegant, 'Curses, like chickens, come home to roost,' is a true one. Mr. Galluli could not testify in his own behalf. Neither did he have time, money, or friends to work for him and get witnesses. And in prison, what could he do? How could that jury help but have doubts? I believe they did have. It was their sworn duty to give him the benefit of them, and that one day they would have to answer to God for their decision. There are some persons who seem to want him hung just for the sake of seeing the act and because it will bring a large number of persons to the city. At least, that is what they say. How any person can become so thoroughly depraved, I cannot imagine. I think we had better disperse with foreign missionaries, let the heathens go, and try to civilize our own home heathens. I do not wish you to think that I hold him guiltless. He ought not to have killed Mr. Lannan, but there is no justice in giving him such a sentence. It is too barbarous. Let him be punished some other way. I think after having suffered such terrible agony as he has, sending him to Michigan City would be sufficient. Just think what the poor soul has suffered. Don't you think he ought to have and could get another hearing? If not, don't you think Governor Williams could be persuaded to change the sentence? Persons have told me they would give money to help defray his expenses, that there would be enough raised in town to pay his lawyers. Won't you just try and save his life? There are many in town who could testify that Galluli was just crazy from the effects of liquor that night. Mrs. B just left here, and she said Mr. B, Mr. B, Mr. B, and herself could testify that Galluli was just crazy from the effects of liquor that night, and that when she asked him why he did not have them for witnesses, He replied that he did not know who brought him to jail. The poor soul was almost insane and did not know what to do. Do work and save his life, and I hope the bread you cast upon the waters may return after many days to you. Respectfully. Suppose it be true, as the writer of the letter says, that other guilty persons have escaped punishment. Is that a reason the rule should continue? Is not crime on the increase? Have not the people been merciful as long as they can with safety to this community? How can that lady say the jury must have had doubts? No one has any doubt in regard to the murder. Galluli committed the act. The evidence showed that he contemplated the murder and that there was malice in it. It was no sudden act. He had plenty of time to reflect over the consequences. We entirely agree with the lady in her estimation of those who want Galluli hanged just to bring a crowd here or to see the execution. We've never seen an execution of this sort, though we've had many opportunities, and we never want to see one. A man who hankers after such a scene must have a curious heart or brain or both. Besides, if it should occur, it would not, of course, be open for the public. The lady mistakes when she says Galluli was not permitted to testify. He could have done so, but declined. We regret that, with such an appeal, we cannot feel it to be our duty to make an effort in behalf of this unfortunate criminal. We are opposed to a new trial, but it would please us if the governor would commute the sentence to imprisonment for life. But we do not feel like asking that this be done. If it shall be done, then Galluli is permitted to remain in prison. We would feel that this punishment was sufficient. But this murder strikes us as such a cold-hearted, deliberate one that we must be excused from leading off in any effort in favor of the prisoner.
November 17th, 1877. Last Sunday afternoon, at his own request, Michael Galluli, the condemned murderer, was taken to Nicholson's gallery, where two negatives were taken for some pictures that he desired to send to his relatives. After sitting for the negatives, at the suggestion of Mr. Nicholson, a phrenological examination of the prisoner's head was made, and a reporter, being present, jotted down the observations made by Mr. Nicholson, who early in life devoted considerable study to the subject of phrenology. Mr. Galluli has a highly wrought temperament and is remarkably excitable. With such an organization, the effect of alcohol would bring about very bad results. The head is quite large and well shaped. The faculties of reason are largely developed, showing good comprehension, and the subject is highly responsible for any of his acts. His perceptive faculties are also well developed. There is one deficiency in the cultivation of the retentive part of the memory. He has a good intuitive knowledge of human nature. Thousands of men have the organ of destructiveness more largely developed. A good deal of tenacity of purpose and firmness of character is observable. He has a great deal of self-esteem, relies much on his own perception. Caution is well developed, as is also ambition. With early education and training, Michael Galluli would have been a good man. His reasoning faculties are first rate. He thinks more than he talks. The organ of secretiveness is not fully developed. There is no element for theft to be observed. The ruin of his character is due to the influence of stimulants. He is sociable, likes company and jovial companions. Throughout the examination, Galluli's demeanor was good, although he seemed embarrassed. He expressed himself as satisfied with the phrenological examination and thanked Mr. Nicholson. As the prisoner was about to leave the gallery with Sheriff Freeman, our reporter tried to interview him, but he did not seem disposed to say much. He remarked that he did not think that the Tribune had treated him fairly.
When we asked him if he expected the governor to commute his sentence to imprisonment for life, he answered, "No, I'm told by lawyers that he has no power to do such an act." When asked, "Are you hopeful that the Supreme Court will give you a new trial?" he answered, "No, I haven't much hope of that." And he added, "It seems that everybody here is against me. I guess that people go on the principle that when a man is going downhill, they all want to give him a kick." And with this remark, he disappeared at the door. If you feel like this episode's been entertaining enough to reward the podcaster with a refreshing beverage, point your browser to www.buymeacoffee.com/crimehistorian, though I can't promise my coffee won't be a bourbon. The next case of a lynching in Kokomo was perpetuated on the night of April 3, 1881, 3 years after the Gallooly case was concluded, by the hanging of Richard Long. On Saturday night previous, Mr. Ed Pritchard's little 3-year-old daughter was taken from its cradle and carried into the backyard, where an outrage was attempted upon her person. She returned into the house and awoke her mother, who cared for the child, but made no discoveries until morning, when from the complaining of the child, it was discovered that she had in some way been injured. This man Long had been around and acting strangely, and by his conduct excited some suspicion. He was finally arrested and put in jail on Sunday. All sorts of rumors were in circulation, and diligent search and inquiry were instituted to get evidence to convict him of the outrage upon the child. The news of the occurrence spread rapidly, and a large crowd was assembled near the jail most of the day on Sunday, and it was thought the attempt to lynch him that night would be made. But the crowd assembled, or that portion of it that contemplated the lynching, had not succeeded in imbibing a sufficient amount of artificial courage and concluded to await until the next night. During Monday, other criminal acts of Long were developed and added to the excitement. Men from Rochester came down and identified a horse, a watch, and a pair of boots as stolen property. This fact settled the character of Long in the minds of the crowd and added to what was alleged as connecting him with the outrage on this child, settled the question. On Monday afternoon, the excitement seemed to subside, but it was noticeable that those who favored lynching were frequently seen together holding whispered consultations. It was more and more evident that extreme measures were contemplated. Soon after midnight, a masked mob assembled at the jail and proceeded to cut the lock off the door with a cold chisel and thus effected an entrance. The prisoner was secured and marched to the iron bridge at the foot of Main Street. The mob took possession of the bridge and would not allow any to pass but their own crowd, except Mr. McCoon, the minister of the Congregational Church, who talked to and prayed with the prisoner. J.F. Vailey made a stirring appeal to the mob to desist, but to no purpose. They had come to hang the man and were not to be diverted from their purpose. Before Long was swung off, he asked to be allowed to sing a song, which was granted him when he sang in a clear and distinct manner and voice 2 or 3 verses of the song "Keep My Grave Green," after which the supports upon which he stood were removed and he hung there by neck until dead. After he was dead, he was cut down and carried to the courthouse, and the next day buried. December 8, 1877. The people of Kokomo have been much interested in the Gallooly case. Many, who have always been opposed to capital punishment, have stood aloof
seemingly satisfied to allow the law to take its course. Others, who appeared to be affected by sentiment, complained that Galluli, and not somebody else, has been selected to hang. Although threats of lynching were freely made at the time of the murder, after the excitement had somewhat subsided, our people consented to wait until the murderer would be tried, believing that the premeditated character of the crime would bring about justice. The trial came off in the October term of court, while the facts were still fresh in the minds of the people, and lasted a week. The evidence elicited was clear and strong. The jury, after being out for 14 hours, returned a verdict of guilty, then that the prisoner suffer the death penalty. A motion for a new trial was made, but was overruled by the judge, and Galluli received his sentence to hang by the neck until dead, the execution to take place January 30, 1878. The governor cannot commute the sentence, for while the Constitution of the state provided for the commutation of a death sentence by the governor, it says it shall be done, quote, according to the statutes provided, unquote, etc., and the legislature has never enacted any statute on the subject. Thomas W. Lannan, the murdered policeman, was an Irishman by birth, a Catholic, and one of the most ardent working members of the Father Matthew Total Abstinence Society in Kokomo. His age was 28, and he was unmarried. About 3 months previous to his death, he was put on the police force and had served efficiently and honorably. He had no fear, never shirked duty, and performed his work well. His death was universally regretted. Michael Galluli is a man of medium stature, rather heavy set and smooth face, except his mustache, which is like his hair, very straight and red in color. By his picture, it will be seen that he is not a bad-looking man. In a recent interview, he remarked, quote, "I never would have killed Lannan if I hadn't been drunk at the time. He is 23 years old and unmarried. He has no near relatives except his mother, who was with him during the trial. She resides at Sandusky, Ohio, where she now is." The Junction locality where the murder was committed has been the scene of a great many crimes in the last few years. Several cases of manslaughter have happened there, and tramps, thieves, gamblers, and criminals of all sorts have made the Junction vicinity a terror to our people. Many men have been robbed there, and a few years ago, the Junction Hotel was burned to the ground, the work of an incendiary. Only a month or so ago, the mutilated body of a man was found on the railroad at the crossing, and the coroner's jury returned a verdict that he came to his death from intoxication, the supposition being that he sat down on the track while in that condition, and the cars soon passed over him. He is believed by many that he was drugged and placed on the track to cover up some crime that must have been perpetrated before. Besides the crimes that have been committed at the Junction, several fatal accidents have happened there in the last few years. Three employees of the Bennett Sawmill have met death by being mutilated with a circular saw. An appeal in the Galluli case has been taken to the Supreme Court, and his lawyers, Messrs. Bryan and Garrigus, have just taken the legal papers to Indianapolis. Exceptions are taken to the judge's charge and the admissibility of parts of the evidence, and also to a portion of the closing address of the prosecuting attorney. Although the Supreme Court is governed by the merest technicalities in the law, there is only about one chance in 100 for Galluli to get a new trial. It is said that Governor Williams, although personally opposed to capital punishment, cannot interfere with the decision of jurors, and so it is quite probable that Michael Galluli will be hanged on the day set. The place for the execution has not been fixed. A high fence will be erected around the gallows, and the execution will not be for the public gaze. January 12, 1878. The application for a new trial in the Galluli case, taken to the Supreme Court,
was decided in Indianapolis on Tuesday afternoon. The decisions rendering on the exceptions taken are as follows. Quote, the fact that a juror is not a householder or a freeholder is waived if the question if he was or was not such was not asked him when the jury was impaneled. The fact that a person has expressed an opinion before he is called as a juror is no objection to his sitting in the case as a juror if the opinion expressed was not formed on the facts of the case, but from mere rumors, and would not influence his action in the cause. A clergyman may be allowed to testify in a cause except as to confessions made by a party in the course of church discipline. Drunkenness is no excuse for a crime, but if so long continued as to destroy mental power of persons as to intention, it is a good ground of defense. Provocation, to be any excuse for crime, must be recent and before the party provoked has had time to cool. Unquote. Another cause assigned for a new trial was the refusal of the court to permit the defendant to prove on the trial, quote, that the deceased, Thomas Lannon, had made threats against the defendant and used insulting and abusive language toward him and treated him disrespectfully and had challenged him to a fight which the defendant refused to accept and had made threats of personal violence which had been communicated to the defendant. Unquote. On this point, the Supreme Court says it was a sufficient reason for refusing to admit the offered testimony that no time was stated when the offensive conduct occurred. The judgment was affirmed. There is now no hope for Gulli's life unless the governor interferes. A petition now being circulated here, praying the governor to commute the sentence to imprisonment for life, will be taken to Indianapolis in a few days, together with the following certificate from Lima, Ohio, in reference to the character of Gulli while a resident of that place, which is handed to us with a request that we publish it. Quote, Lima, Allen County, Ohio, October 26, 1877. The undersigned citizens of Lima say that Michael Gulli was raised in this city from the time he was 8 or 9 years of age until about 3 years ago. He lived with his stepfather, Robert Clark, and his mother. Both of them are of the highest respectability and have the sympathy of the whole community in their great trouble. Young Gulli, as he grew up, was disposed to occasionally drink too much intoxicating drinks, but he never was vicious or malignant, and he never was charged or suspected of any offense against the laws while living at Lima. The affidavit was signed by the mayor of Lima, a probate judge, an attorney, a late member of Congress, publisher of the Lima Gazette, the county auditor and prosecuting attorney, editors of the Lima Democrat and Courier, January 19, 1878. A Tribune reporter called at the county jail yesterday afternoon and had a prolonged interview with Michael Gulli, who in all probability will suffer the death penalty on a week from next Wednesday. The prisoner has been moved from the south to the north cell, and by the kind permission of Sheriff Freeman, our reporter was allowed to sit at the grate and converse with Gulli. The cell is quite dark, and a candle is kept burning all day. It is a gloomy sight to look in at the grate into the narrow depths of the cell, and there is no pleasant feature about the place to divert the prisoner's attention from the revolting thought of his impending fate. When our reporter called in at the grate, "Good morning, Mike," the latter was lounging on a cot, eating an apple, and seeming to be in good spirits. He greeted us warmly, and upon our asking him if he was willing to talk, he answered, "Of course, I am always glad to see those who care to call, if I know they don't come from curiosity." He came to the front of the cell and commenced talking at once. He had been reading a city paper, and his first remark was, "I don't know why people want to kick me down the hill so much. The other day, the editor of the other paper came down here to see me,
and when his name was sent in, I said I didn't want to see him. I don't know what he came for. He has done me enough harm already. When I wouldn't see him, he went back to his office and wrote an article that don't contain any truth at all. It is not true that I told the editor of the other paper that that paper had treated me more fairly than the Tribune. On the contrary, I stated that of the two, the Tribune had treated me most fairly. Neither did I say that I would receive none except Father Lordeman. The editor has no right to think such a thing, except that I declined to see him. I'm glad to see all who sympathize with me. Unquote. He went on to say that Father Lordeman had called several times to see him, but not so much as others. He said that he did not feel badly toward the Tribune. Quote, "There is only one thing that I blame you so much for, and that is for printing those pictures. I didn't think when I was at the photograph gallery that day my picture was to be used in that way." Unquote. He said he wanted to thank everyone who signed the petition to the governor to commute his sentence to imprisonment for life. Quote, "But a good many people here would like to see me hang just for the fun of it. They can only take my life, that's all. I hope if I am to die, they will be satisfied." Unquote. Our reporter asked him if he had much hope. Quote, "Oh no, I don't look for the governor to interfere. I guess my friends will do all they can for me, though now that it's gone so far." Unquote. Throughout the interview, the prisoner seemed to be in his usual mood, although his manner of speaking was more earnest when alluding to the injustice of some of his friends. Our reporter handed him a cigar through the grate, and when he left, Gallooly was puffing away like a free man. Since his confinement in jail last August, Gallooly has decreased in flesh considerably. Then he weighed about 160, and now only about 120. His health has been poor, and close confinement has sorely tested his physical strength, which at first seemed so great. While our reporter was talking to him, the mother of the prisoner came to the cell grate and passed a few words with her son. She came here from Lima on Tuesday and will remain until the governor considers the question of a commutation or until the day of execution.
January 26, 1878. Mrs. Clark, the mother of Michael Gallooly, accompanied by Miss Annie Giles, went to Indianapolis on last Monday afternoon to interview the governor in regard to a commutation of her son's death sentence to imprisonment for life. When she reached Indianapolis, it was learned that the governor was out of the city, visiting the reform school at Plainfield, and would not return until the following day. She remained until Tuesday at the Occidental Hotel, and Governor Williams returning at 10 o'clock a.m., he was informed of her arrival and desire to see him. He visited her at once in the parlors, and an interview with closed doors lasting half an hour was had. The writer was present during that time. The governor stated that he had just returned from Plainfield and had not had a moment's time since receiving the petitions to review the case. He seemed to be deeply moved by the tearful pleadings of the mother and said to her in substance, quote, "All my sympathies, my dear madam, are with you. I am opposed to capital punishment and always have been, but there is a law of the state which I must answer that is higher than my sympathies. I have not examined the papers in the case as yet. Indeed, I know nothing of it, but I will give them careful and patient attention. I must act in accordance with the evidence adduced at the trial and will aim to give an impartial verdict. I can't say now what my decision will be. I will take up the case tomorrow or next day and expect to decide by Saturday at farthest. The case is a very sad one throughout, and as I have said before, my sympathies are all with you." The governor was very much affected while he talked and seemed to want to impress the mother with the fact that he meant to make a just decision and act conscientiously. August 8, 1899. Indiana Governor James Mount granted a parole to Michael J. Galluli, who will be sadly missed at the Michigan City Prison, as he has had the privilege of going outside the walls and he has been the right-hand man of the officials. He shot and killed policeman Lannan at Kokomo Junction. He said he thought he had been punished sufficiently, and he promises never to touch liquor again. He will go to his brother at Whiting.
Appendix. The 1882 history of Howard County, Indiana, devotes a paragraph to this case. Quote, August 22, 1877, Michael Galluli shot and killed Thomas W. Lannan at the Junction for the alleged interference in his relation with some young woman of the neighborhood. Giving way to strong drink and yielding to the taunting and jeers of a vile gang called the Mullahan Gang, who mostly congregated about the Junction, he became desperate and shot Lannan dead, for which he was arrested and tried for murder in the first degree, found guilty, and sentenced to hang. But upon the representation made to Governor Williams, his sentence was commuted to imprisonment for life. Unquote. Jackson Morrow's 1909 History of Howard County, Indiana, talks about the Mullahan Gang thus. During the 70s, the Mullahan Gang flourished in the Junction District. All manner of crimes were laid at the doors of this reputed gang, but if guilty, its members were never ascertained, apprehended, and brought to justice. It was claimed that its ramifications extended so far that justice was nullified and detection rendered out of the case, and that it perpetrated crime with impunity and after a studied plan. A wholesale robbery of farmhouses and city residences of silverware was one plan supposed to be backed by the gang, and several bodies cut to pieces upon the railroad tracks at the Junction were said to have been murdered and then placed there by this gang, the booty of which, it was claimed, was sold in Chicago by those whose names, if revealed, would have caused surprise. At any rate, the terror of the gang caused deep apprehension in the minds and hearts of the Kokomo public, and when the Mullahan Saloon passed away and the reputed gang melted away, the public breathed a sigh of relief. The Morrow history goes on to say that after his conviction, Galluli had threatened the death of the trial judge, but, quote, he ended his days quietly, unquote. A 1964 article in the Kokomo Tribune by Jim Bannon says of the Mullahan Gang, quote, looming large and dark in Kokomo's past is a group known as the Mullahan Gang. The gang reportedly hung out at a tavern owned by Mart Mullahan at a place north of the city known only as the Junction. And in that vicinity, in a year's time, the bodies of about 10 men were found on the railroad track. It appeared the men, all strangers to Kokomo, had been run over by trains. Examination showed, however, that most of them had been killed before being placed on the tracks. They were all well-dressed, and townspeople figured the gang had lured them to the Junction, robbed them, and then killed them and let the train run over them to destroy evidence of foul play. No money or identification papers were ever found on the bodies. None were ever identified, and all were buried by the township. Mart Mullahan finally closed his tavern because of public pressure and moved to a western state. The gang dispersed, and from time to time, no more bodies were found on the tracks at the Junction. In a 1951 letter to the Kokomo Tribune, a former city resident by the name of E.L. Langston wrote a letter recalling how the Mullahan Gang operated. Quote, it had cloth for men's clothing for sale, and its members would work the streets looking for customers. When they saw a man who looked as though he had money, they would tell him how inexpensively they were selling cloth at a place up the way. The victim would visit the place, plunged through a trap door, and there he would be robbed and killed, his body being found the next morning on the railroad track. Unquote. That was Assassination at Kokomo Junction, the Galuli Lantern Affray, called from the historic pages of the Kokomo Saturday Tribune, the 1882 History of Howard County, and Jackson Morrow's 1909 History of Howard County. We offer a special thanks to the staff at Howard County Library's Genealogy Room and listener Anthony R. Jones, no relation, who saw the mobile production unit outside that library where I was engaged in research on another matter. After I got his message telling me to look into the Mullahan gang, I dug around a bit and came up with this episode. Residents of the Safe House can take a deeper dive into Kokomo's criminal past in the case file posted at www.patreon.com/truecrimehistorian, where you can also enjoy ad-free editions of all new episodes, treasures from the True Crime Historian Vault not available anywhere else, and whatever personal services you require. True Crime Historian is a creation of Popular Media. Musical contributors include Nico Vitesse, Lucia Larezza, Joy E., Daniel Moe, David Sams, Rachel Schott, and David Hitch. Some music and sound effects licensed from podcastmusic.com. Media management and original graphics for all new episodes by Sean R. Miller Jones. And as for me, was disposed to occasionally drink too much intoxicating drinks, but he never was vicious or malignant. I'm true crime historian Richard O. Jones, signing off for now.